Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Rabona Podcast. Thank you once again for joining us. I'm here again with Ryan Hun. Hi, Ryan.
Hello.
Michael De Silva, unfortunately, is indisposed. He's not indisposed, isn't he? He's in the UK, so he can't join us. But he sends his kind regards. And this week we're going to be discussing Derby Day, Delight and Despair, some crucial games from around Europe, primarily the Premier League. But Ryan, anything else we should be looking at?
We are going to obviously cover, Arsenal Spurs, Liverpool Everton, Chelsea Fulham. We're going to then talk a little bit about Southampton, who have just fired Mark Hughes.
Yeah, breaking news.
So we're going to touch a little bit on them. We're also going to touch on a couple of records, 100% starts to the season, which have now ended in Arsenal Women and PSG.
Right.
And a few other things as well.
Such as the UEFA club competition.
Yes.
Shout out to Michelle St. Paddy, the wonderful name, Mash St. Paddy on Twitter, is his Twitter handle, at Mash St. Paddy, who's given us some great questions and great feedback during the first few months of Rabona. We're very grateful to him personally, and also not just for listening, but for his input. So please feel encouraged, all of you on social media, to chip in with thoughts, feedback, because we really appreciate your support.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it'd be good to hear more from people who are listening, because it lets us know that there's more people listening than, you know, our extended family.
You'll have to chop that out. No, keep it in.
Oh, just a quick disclaimer before we get into the nitty-gritty. Moose's stomach is making crazy loud noises because we didn't do pastries this week.
You actually mentioned this.
And we usually do pastries. Before, we usually go full Sunday supplement, but Monday supplement, and we didn't do any today, and he is
growling,
noisy.
Yeah, so if you hear some strange acoustics, that's not a black hole coming to swallow.
Yeah, the technical system. Stuff is fine. Yeah. It's just Moose's tummy.
Yeah, those gremlins are actually my stomach. So yeah, now that you've publicly shamed me, let's get into Derby Day, Delight and Despair. One of the reasons Ryan is so cock-a-hoop is that his beloved Arsenal have defeated Tottenham Hotspur by 4-2. Exhilarating performance, superb game of football. And Ryan, what does that mean for Arsenal and for Spurs?
I thought that was probably the best Premier League game of the season so far.
Right.
Very, very intense from the first minute. Arsenal notorious for not starting particularly well this season, still yet to lead at halftime in any Premier League game this season.
Right.
But the two games that they have started more brightly have been arguably their two toughest games since the opening defeats to Chelsea and Manchester City, which were Liverpool at home and Spurs at home. And I thought Arsenal in the opening 10 minutes on Sunday were brilliant, and Spurs did not settle very well, and I thought Arsenal deserved the lead. Spurs came back into it and were pretty good value, I thought, for a half-time lead, actually.
Right.
But in the second half, I mean, Emery made two really bold changes at half-time, took off Alex Iwobi and Henrik Mkhitaryan and brought on Aaron Ramsey and Alexander Lacazette. And tactically, I thought he handled the game extremely well, really exploited Tottenham's formation where they were playing a kind of diamond midfield, and which gave Arsenal a lot of space wide. And I clocked that actually both teams, I think, played three different systems throughout the game. So it was not only just a brilliant kind of spectacle, but also a really, really intense tactical battle.
Well, everyone was thinking. That's the thing. What I love about Pochettino and Emery is that they are coaches who are constantly, I mean, it's funny because tinkering was something that was, you know, in our kind of slightly sort of Neolithic British press, tinkering was something that's criticized. But I think the greatest coaches of our day are tinkerers. They're constantly trying to find new advantages.
Yeah, definitely. And I think stepping back from it, I think the thing that was really, really encouraging for me was that Arsenal matched Spurs on the things that Spurs have had an advantage over Arsenal in the past few seasons in terms of tactical intensity.
Right.
And having a real bite about them. You know, Spurs have always been a bit of a tough, well, not always, but especially since Pochettino have been there, they've definitely been more physical than Arsenal.
Well, it was funny because I saw there was a moment when Vertonghen gets his second yellow card. Mm. And he actually gets the ball first, but then leaves his foot on, was it Aubameyang?
Lacazette, sorry.
He leaves his foot in. Mm. And it was fascinating because I thought to myself, that sums this up. The speed that Arsenal were pressing, the way they were closing down, it was just ferocious. And that kick was really just frustration. And you saw so much of that. I mean, Torreira's goal, for example, the way that Arsenal just poured forward. Mm. It was brutal. It was almost like a slight sort of relief when Arsenal did score, to the pressure off Spurs. You know, they got the restart. And there's an incredible stat, Dele Alli. Dele Alli, I think, only completed six passes second half.
Four of which were kickoffs.
Kickoffs. I mean, unbelievable stat.
Yeah.
He was frozen out to an extent, or isolated.
Yeah, I think the first 10 minutes of the second half, Spurs looked good. They had a couple of really good set-piece opportunities, very similar positions to where they got their first goal. But after that, I just think Arsenal kind of blew them away a little bit. Spurs also, though, I think, you know, I think Pochettino's team selection was kind of understandable in one aspect. This was their third pretty intense game in a week. You know, they played Chelsea last weekend and then they had a pretty hard fought win against Inter midweek. But I thought resting Alderweireld really played into Arsenal's hands, who's, you know, he's undoubtedly their best defender. And they've got Southampton at home this week, who have just sacked Mark Hughes. Right. So maybe that would have been the one to rest him for. But then again, Pochettino said after the game, he has all these players in the squad who can play. But I think Arsenal really targeted Foyt and Vertonghen. I can't remember the exact percentage, but I don't think a single Spurs defender had over 70% pass completion yesterday, which shows how Arsenal harried them from the very beginning.
If someone had said to you 6 months ago, you would destroy Spurs, dismantle them, destroy whatever, 4-2 in a derby, and neither Ozil nor Ramsey will be involved as starters, you'd have been like, yeah. Do you know what I mean? But the fact that, like, I mean, Ramsey was important, but the fact that the center of creative gravity has shifted away from those two players significantly is quite...
It's a lot more collective now than it has been. You know, Arsenal really relied on either Alexis Sanchez to get him out of trouble or Mesut Ozil to really pull strings or Aaron Ramsey's goals a few seasons ago. Now it seems a lot more collective.
Right.
But to be fair, Ramsey changed the game.
Yeah.
He came on at halftime, scored and contributed 2 assists. And that's actually another point that I want to make about Emery, is that he changed the system, or essentially played 2 up top with Ramsey behind. And instead of having like a central striker, Lacazette and Aubameyang played quite wide, which allowed Ramsey space through the middle. And it was just this really interesting little tweak that seemed to give Ramsey huge amount of space, and he caused Spurs real damage.
We don't know who to mark. That's the problem with that.
Yeah.
If someone's breaking like that, I don't want to sort of use too many sort of false midfield or false strike analogies, but the late arriving run is something that actually Lampard did. You had Drogba.
It's a false 10.
I suppose it is in a sense. Like, it's when you see Aubameyang, I mean, I would classify Aubameyang as actually a conventional, traditional centre forward.
Yeah.
Having said that, when the movement is like that and you allow the breaking runner, it's something which Manchester United tried to do before with Lukaku peeling away and Lingard coming through.
Yeah.
It's incredibly powerful because when you know, Ramsey is one of the best late runners in European football.
Yeah, definitely.
But before we're getting to the tactics of it, but I want to sort of zoom out slightly and talk about Emery and Wenger, because I mentioned earlier the Twitter follower of ours, Michelle, which you can find, who can find at Mash St. Paddy on Twitter. And he said, look, is there not a question that we've understated significantly the good state that Wenger left Arsenal in and the squad in? And actually, Emery's doing a great job. But at the same time, do we have to give credit to Wenger for these foundations that he left in place?
100%. Despite undoubtedly Arsenal's performances becoming questionable more regularly in the last few years, and they're, you know, dropping out of the top 4 and definitely needing a change, I don't think that Arsenal were in a position to facilitate that kind of managerial change 2 or 3 years ago. They didn't have the personnel in place above Wenger. And I mean, I don't know Arsene Wenger. And
not yet.
Not
we're
yet.
Working on it.
One day. One day we will be friends. But I've always had this kind of sneaking suspicion that he cared more about just his job
right.
as a manager there. I think he kind of felt this real level of custodianship, which could sometimes from the outside seem a bit like he was kind of running it as like a dictatorship. And, you know, he was everything at the club. But
are you calling him the Angela Merkel of North London football?
But what I mean by that is that he was one of the only people at that level of the club who was still there from Highbury.
Right.
I think that he knew now that maybe with the additions of Raoul Sanyei and, you know, people like Hosfami and Sven Mislintat and this team of people that were operating above him or right. the manager at the club, whereas he was always pretty much top dog,
right.
even though he wasn't running the club, he kind of was. He knew that now someone like Unai Emery could walk in and really have the tools to push that team on. And whatever people say about Arsene Wenger, I genuinely think that he just wants Arsenal to do well. I think he's very stubborn, but I don't think he's an idiot. You
right.
know.
With me, with Wenger, the sense I always had was he saw the club going into a sort of decline on the field and he just wanted to turn it around. And I think he was unfortunately out of ideas in terms of, not even out of ideas, I think that Wenger's ideas, put it this way, do you know how like you'll have like these conversations and there's times when like women get talked over and a guy will say the same thing and everyone will be like, wow, what a great idea. I think by the end of Wenger's tenure, ideas that he had were dismissed because he was Wenger. I'm not being funny, like in terms of like, you know, look at the players that he bought. He brought in Aubameyang. He brought in brilliant players, right? And so I almost wonder if Wenger by the end was being overlooked because he was Wenger, because he said a lot of very smart things about the European Super League and whatever. I wonder if the players in the dressing room stopped listening because it was like, well, we've just heard the same old thing. He can't motivate us anymore. And I just wonder if things got a bit stale.
Yeah, I mean,
does that make sense?
I think that's definitely like, it.
People
think...
hating the messenger,
yeah.
The message was fundamentally sound.
I mean, you've had a load of players in that squad who had not been coached by anyone else in their professional career,
right.
really. Hector Bellerin, Alex Iwobi, you know, Ainsley Maitland-Niles, who had a loan spell at Ipswich. But, you know, still, these kind of players who maybe wouldn't respond to Wenger's notorious kind of like jazz approach, where it's like, go and do your thing, guys, you're amazing.
Right.
And I think you've seen that in the improvement of people like Bellerin and Iwobi, you know, coming in with someone with a new idea who's going to point their eyes in a new direction. That's just a natural thing. I don't think many managers would experience anything different. You know,
but
what I mean?
Here's a wider thing as well about Emery's start at Arsenal, which has been very impressive. It just throws into sharp relief just how much of a circus it was to manage PSG at that time. Because I think Tuchel's doing actually a really good job at
PSG.
Me too. And what's interesting to me is Tuchel is not managing the same PSG that Emery was because Neymar is humbled, Mbappe's in the ascendancy, the team is better rounded, the midfield's looking better, like he's dropped out Marquinhos. He's brought in Marquinhos into midfield alongside Verratti and it's looking more solid. It's almost like Emery weathered that storm. And very unfairly, I think Emery was regarded as negative and conservative. This is a guy that went 4-0 up against Barcelona in the Champions League. People forget that. This is the guy that won three Europa Leagues with Sevilla.
In
playing
a row.
Astonishing football. I mean, I'm just like, this perception of Emery as defensive. Why? Because he played bad against a couple of English teams.
I mean, that Sevilla side at the time.
But really, that's
was
what
a
it
real,
is.
It was a must watch.
But can I be brutal? Is it because Emery had a PSG team that played bad against a couple of English teams and the perception was shaped from that? I wonder, because where else could it have come from?
The only real significant blip on his record was really at Spartak.
No one knows about Spartak, like in the British press.
Yeah, but he did a fantastic job at Valencia. He did an amazing job at Sevilla and he did a pretty good job at PSG. I mean, the only thing he really messed up on was that first season when they didn't win the league. But that Monaco side was incredible.
He lost over two legs to Manchester City in very abject fashion, and that's why this is happening.
Yeah.
It's those two. I hate to be brutal, but everything else in Emery's career suggested he would be playing exciting attacking football and would ultimately be a success in a team or in a club that had the actual structure, the responsible structure, that wasn't just looking at soft power like, you know, a lot of Qatar's investments have been doing.
Yeah.
So I just feel like Emery has been vindicated. the club Arsenal. I feel very passionate about this. I'm not an Arsenal fan, but I'm very passionate about football structures and managers getting their fair due and getting actually the acclaim they deserve for doing very good jobs in complex situations, as Emery did at PSG and as he's doing at Arsenal.
I think his appointment made a lot of sense. And I, you know, again, not wanting to blow my own trumpet, but I remember talking to Chris Tironi, who used to do the Arsenal America podcast on Twitter, saying that before the announcement, when there was a lot of noise about Arteta, and I said, I'm surprised that there's not more noise about Emery, actually, because he was available. It was a perfect kind of profile and CV, if you like. For where Arsenal were, it was very similar to kind of when he took over Valencia. Right. You know, they weren't at the level that PSG were. And I think that he's kind of proving that that appointment was a very, very good one. I mean, it's still early days in his reign. You know, we're 6 months in just. But that felt like the first game where he fully arrived, if you know what I mean. I mean, that's 19 unbeaten for Arsenal now, but many of that have been against sides that they should beat, which is still not to discredit that run. But a lot of people can be like, oh, well, you know, you beat Fulham or you've done this or you've done that. But like beating Spurs in a derby in that fashion, because Arsenal have beaten Spurs many times. Right. It's a derby. It happens. Like it was 2-5-2s and stuff like that under Wenger's late reign. But I think it was just the style and the intensity and kind of outspursing Spurs in a way.
Yes.
In terms of like what Spurs are so good at. I mean, from a Spurs point of view, because this has been very Arsenal focused so far, I don't think it's anything really to worry about. I think it's a derby. They're such standalone fixtures. 3 games in a week of that intensity. You know, Arsenal had a long trip to the Ukraine in midweek, but they took essentially a youth side.
Right.
I think Emery knew that, and which is why I think he made those changes at half time, because he knew that bringing on Lacazette and Ramsey, 2 very hard runners against a tiring Spurs defence. You know,
I just think we're in danger. Yeah, I think that's right. I think Spurs fans need to be careful of drawing the wrong conclusions from the defeat. I think there's a psychological issue. There's a psychological issue with Spurs and this derby fixture. I do think there is, unfortunately. I think just because, I mean, someone said it, there's his Twitter handle is, I don't know how to pronounce it, but it's at @THTRUNK, who's a great follower on Spurs. And he said, look, we are the younger brother treating them with too much deference. And I think there's an element of that. I think that has been a problem in these big derby games where, and maybe you see it to an extent with Everton still, where there's a slight sense of recent history being so overwhelming in the dominant club's favour that you kind of defer. And I think that that's something that Spurs maybe have to address. But I think the great issue with them is they've got to find their Torreira. Because Torreira, I think we've not really mentioned him properly, in terms of his intensity, this is a guy who I think had the highest numbers of ball recoveries in Serie A last year for Sampdoria.
Yep.
His stats were off the scale, goes to the World Cup, was superb in the 2-0 game. I mean, I talk about this game a lot, but France-Uruguay in the World Cup, France 2, Uruguay 0, that midfield battle, him and Bentancourt up against Pogba and Kante was outstanding. And he's just gone, not up and up, because his performance level's been the same. What's incredible is his exposure's increased and he's kept playing the same style. And his finish was wonderful. This is a guy who can really do it all. He can hold a midfield, he can be the surging runner, and he can also finish, he can start and finish the move.
I think he's probably been the signing of the season in the Premier League. That might be me being a little bit biased, being an Arsenal fan.
In terms of a player that's catalysed the change.
I think in terms of, if you look at everything, price was less than £30 million. I think it was in the, I think it was £22 million initially. He's 21, 22 years old. I think he's 22. Kind of plucked, if you like. I know it's a little bit disrespectful to Serie A and Sampdoria, but it wasn't a kind of high profile signing where people are like, wow, yeah, we're getting Lucas Torreira. Everyone's like, ah, okay, who is this guy? You know, for a lot of people won't watch Serie A and a lot of people won't watch Samp. The kind of profile of Arsenal player that you would see them make in Wenger peak, in a way.
My only critique of signing the season is you've got, I mean, Guendouzi, who's in the same midfield, who value for money. If we look at signing of the season, I think we've got Richarlison up there. We've got, obviously, I mean, the hipsters will say Gomez at Everton. I think that's not quite there. But I would say Richarlison at Everton. I think one of those two midfielders, Torreira or Guendouzi, I would say in terms of value for money. But also I think Torreira, for me, I think he just edges it because the change he's encouraged in Arsenal style. I think Jorginho's got to be up there as well. I think it's maybe Jorginho up there as well, or midfielders, I'm noticing.
Yeah.
But does that make sense to you in terms of players that have literally come in and been absolutely game-changing, not just in terms of the price tag, but game-changing in terms of nobody thought at the start of the season, with all respect to Arsenal, they'd be playing this well or this cohesively this early. Nobody thought that Chelsea would be this good this early. And those two players have been absolutely integral to these transformations.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the really encouraging thing is that he's dominant in
right.
a way.
Yeah.
Without necessarily being eye-catchingly dominant, if that makes sense.
He's everywhere. I opened the front door today to record with you. I was expecting to find him, you know, taking out the laundry. You know, he's everywhere.
Everywhere. But I mean, I think that's three Man of the Match awards in the last four Premier League games for him.
Extraordinary.
One thing before we move on, actually, that I want to touch on was the Spurs fan who decided to throw a banana skin at Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang.
Right.
And the reason I wanted to touch on this was because I thought, A, Aubameyang's reaction was amazing. I don't know if you saw, but he kind of looked down. They didn't show it on the TV, but they showed the photo afterwards. And actually, you can see his reaction on the TV where he looks down at it and just stands there with his arms out as if to be like, what?
I love how he acknowledged it.
Yeah, he acknowledged it. He looked down and he was like, what? I think he got arrested, that guy. One thing I do want to say about it is that it's so easy, especially nowadays in with football Twitter, to point score, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's such a shame that a club like Spurs has now got to deal with the backlash caused by some absolute dickhead who's doing something like that. Because, you know, Spurs and Spurs fans are on the end of some pretty horrific abuse themselves, you know. And I don't know what my point is specifically, but I think it just felt that it was good to mention because, you know, I'm an Arsenal fan.
Yeah.
You know, I've been kind of brought up to immensely dislike that football club, but I only really dislike them when it's the North London Derby.
And it doesn't feel like kind of rivalry.
And it's not, you know, Spurs are a great football club. Yeah. And I would advise against Arsenal fans using that as a point scoring thing because it's not a Spurs thing.
Can I say the North London Derby rivalry as unbearable as Arsenal can be on Twitter.
Twitter is the worst.
But can I say this though? I feel like for all of that, all of that to and fro, it's quite a wholesome rivalry. Like as rivalries go, I like it. I like these teams, I love watching them both. I love the way that Spurs go about the game. I love the way it's always, you know what I love about Spurs and Arsenal as clubs and collectively? It's about more than the football. When you watch Spurs play, there's a Spurs way. Mm. And that's been the way for, you know, before I was born. And there's also an Arsenal way. And I really feel like this game at its best represented both teams to their very best in terms of footballing tradition. I think it's enormously to the players' credit and the manager's credit that you have these, you know, foreign managers and foreign players who have embodied in a time when we're talking about people not understanding English culture.
Yeah.
We have, look at the emblems of these clubs. We've got like players in Spurs midfield, Spurs backline, who embody these very, you know, English clubs, English values, I think in a way that is quite inspiring.
Yeah, I think it's the best derby in the Premier League and it has been for a good few years.
I agree.
In terms of how unpredictable it is, what the stakes are, especially since Spurs have been consistently breaking into that top four, it very rarely disappoints. It's always a good game, and I think that's, you know, credit to both teams. But yeah,
awesome.
We've kind of very lyrical about.
No,
this,
we should. So. But let's thoughts and prayers with Spurs fans. But moving forward to Everton,
that's a bit mean.
Well. I think it's
just a game.
It's just a game, but still thoughts and prayers. So Everton, Liverpool, Everton, and a traumatic defeat.
Oh.
For Everton.
Do you know what? I was really worried that this game was going to be terrible. And it didn't disappoint despite being 0-0 until the 96th minute.
This was a proper...
It's a great game.
It was. You know what I loved about it? It was like the intensity and the margins for error being so small as you expect in derby, but the quality of football, the quality of chance creation, that's the key to a derby. Like very often in derbies, it's people neutralise each other. But this was really, I mean, actually, to be honest, if Liverpool had finished better and Everton finished better.
It could have been like 4-4.
Could have been.
At one point I thought, wow, Liverpool should be like 3-3. And then I was like, hang on a minute, Everton should have had at least 3.
The goal is in danger of overshadowing everything. But I want to get into, just talking about Liverpool, because they're only a couple of points back, which is remarkable, you know, considering how well City have started. And that's remarkable given how good City have been. Liverpool are funny because they seem to have... They've solidified, they're tougher, but they have lost a bit of the, I don't know, ruthlessness in attack.
Mm.
They've definitely sacrificed some of that freewheeling, almost what do you call this, a free jazz style. Klopp is a blend of, he's a blend of Wenger and Guardiola, isn't he? He's evolved, I think, into something approaching Guardiola ball.
Yeah, definitely.
But it's still distinctively Liverpool. But, you know, that being said, the goal, the nature of the goal, I mean, so those who haven't seen the goal, Divock Origi scores in the sixth minute of stoppage time.
To be fair, sorry to cut in, but the amount of stuff that was doing the rounds after that, would be very surprised if no one's not seen that goal yet.
Okay, right.
So, do you know what I mean?
But the amazing thing about the goal is that he slices, I mean, Van Dijk slices the volley that leaves the goal so badly, he actually turns away in disgust.
Yeah, Van Dijk's already running back towards his goal.
In disgust.
With his hands on his head, being like, I've effed it, basically, in the last minute. And
the ball drops,
I just, it took me a while to figure out what was going on, to be honest, because it looked like it started curving back. So I was like, oh, it must have gone out of play.
Right.
And then I don't really know.
The ball bounced twice on the crossbar.
I don't really know what Pickford was doing. I don't want to be mean, but I don't really know what he was doing.
He was trying to palm it over the bar, which makes total sense.
But then if he was palming it over the bar, he cupped his hands as if he was going to catch it. So instead of helping it, he basically had his hands the wrong way around to palm it over the bar.
Right.
He had his hands scooped underneath it, which is why it popped back out.
But it's a 1 in 10,000 thing, because if you think about it, the first thing was the problem, because once it bounces on the bar. So the first mistake he made, it was a negligible mistake, right? In 999 times out of 1,000, when he makes contact with it onto the bar, it bounces over.
Yeah.
But it spun onto the bar again and then bounced down. Mm. Like, how often? The odds for the ball to bounce on the crossbar and then bounce again and then to drop for the striker. And can I say, credit to Origi, because how many strikers would have followed up in that situation? And the fact that it dropped right to him is because he was right under the bar at the time, because he followed that. Most strikers wouldn't have followed that ball in.
Yeah.
They wouldn't have. They would have just let it, like, okay, he's tipped over. But Origi gambled. And he's interesting because in terms of his narrative arc, he is a player who has been out on loan, looked very good at the World Cup. I think that was the World Cup or the Euros he was at where he first started starring.
Euros, I think.
The Euros. Looked very good. Went on loan. Seemed as if his career was turning away at Liverpool, but has come back with a vengeance. And when he scored a winner at Derby, goodness knows what they'll do for his confidence. And now he is an extra striker that Liverpool have and come off the bench and be decisive.
I kind of really felt for Everton. It was such a weird goal. It was kind of like, I think you saw it with Silva's reaction afterwards when he was just a bit like,
what the hell?
Oh, it kind of happens. I mean, he kind of like laughed or giggled about it, didn't they? And then they were like having this big old deep chat. But Klopp on the pitch, that was amazing.
Amazing.
Like, sorry to kind of go football banter account, but yeah, I was all in on Klopp just pegging it on the pitch and giving Alisson a hug. After that goal where you're like, what is happening? And then all of a sudden Klopp's on the pitch and you're like, what the hell? Like,
there were some really beautiful Derby moments, actually. There was that. That was an iconic moment. There was Torreira's knee slide and topless celebration after scoring. And there was Guendouzi after the game. Hanging out the car window. And I was like, you know what? That's football. That could have been like a Lazio Roma.
Eric Dier's shush celebration as well, which is now
the
got memed kind of thing.
I mean, yeah, I mean, it's so interesting watching people get caught up in the emotion of the derby. And, you know, for Klopp to run on the pitch like that, yes, that's because it was such a huge victory, but it's also the unique atmosphere the derby creates. And I want to just say, I think that on the whole, clubs did themselves immense credit.
Yeah, definitely.
This derby weekend. And I think we have to celebrate that, because sometimes, you know, it's easy to be like all doom and gloom, and we're not always like that, but it's important to celebrate these things when they happen. They're really great.
Yeah, definitely. And actually, leading on to the third derby in the Premier League, Chelsea-Fulham, which was closer than you would probably expect going into the game.
Right,
and it should have been closer, actually. Yeah. Chelsea winning 2-0, going 1-0 up quite early with Pedro. But Fulham could have really got back into that and probably should have had a couple, I think.
But very positive for Fulham. They beat Southampton. It was a good win for them.
Yeah, and I don't think they would have expected anything out of that game apart from a performance. And I think they
Ranieri gave a performance. Is already making a difference, isn't he?
Yeah, definitely. That just shows that, you know, he's not one-hit wonder.
Yeah, he's not spent for. The great Matt Ranieri, I mean, when he won that league title, for me, it was wonderful. It was almost like, you know, in the NFL, they had John Elway winning the Super Bowl right at the end of his storied career.
Mm.
And everyone knew that Elway was one of the greats. But it was almost like they'd always see these people going, oh, no, he's not a great because he hasn't won. And Ranieri winning with Leicester just really when he ascended, you know, to the mountaintop, it was like, yeah, this guy's just a brilliant coach.
Mm.
He's just a very good coach. And if anyone is right to bring Fulham out of that, it's a guy who's got the perfect mix of carrot and stick.
Yeah, definitely. And he seems like someone who, you know, when things are getting a little bit tough or morale is low or something, who can really lift a group of players. And you kind of see that. I think Fulham have been much better in the last couple of games. And, you know, against Chelsea, in the kind of form they were in a few weeks ago, you'd expect them to ship like four or five.
Right.
And, you know, they were nowhere near as open. And I think it's signs are looking good for Fulham.
Absolutely. What they want to do is, well, on the derby theme, maybe just jump over to South America very briefly.
Yes.
Because the latest news on River Boca, Libertadores second leg, is that River have refused to play in Madrid, which is very interesting.
So what's going to happen then?
This is going to be like almost the never-ending story, isn't it? Sort of,
because it's due to take place this Saturday, right? The 9th.
That's the talk. I mean, yeah, so Saturday night is the schedule. But
at the Bernabeu.
River aren't keen on that. River have conducted themselves, I think, really, really well. Yeah. You mentioned on the last podcast how, you know, they'd come out and said, look, the game shouldn't go ahead. They've really done things the right way. Coming out and saying this and saying, we don't want to play in Madrid. I respect that because I feel there's, you're telling us in the whole of South America, we can't find a venue for this. In the whole of Argentina, we can't find a venue for this. You know, I think they're right to sort of say, look, this isn't just about the rivalry. This is about, you know, the commercialization of football. This isn't a traveling fair. This isn't the Harlem Globetrotters.
Yeah, and also they've lost their home leg of the biggest game for years.
Having played superbly in the first leg.
Exactly. Basically, it's level going into the second leg. I don't really know where this is going, this situation. I mean, it's changing constantly, day by day. You know, I had a chat early last week with Brenda Elsie about the Copa Libertadores.
We'll hear from her later.
Yeah, we're going to include a little bit of that conversation. Basically, we had a long chat, but so much has happened since that, you know, it's kind of proved some of it a little bit dated. So we're going to include some stuff that Brenda touched on, a little bit more of the aspects outside of the football and wider kind of South American factors. But yeah, we recorded that before we knew where the second leg was going to take place. And at the time, a lot of the noises were coming out, it was going to be in Doha.
Mm.
And that just seemed like a terrible decision, but one you can just kind of understand going ahead. It's like, oh, right, you know, kind of loads of money. Here you go, do it in Doha, get it done. It's going to be, you know, very kind of sterile. And actually, when the announcement got made that it was going to be at the Bernabeu, I was kind of like, huh. Actually, I don't agree with it in a way, because I don't think that you should take that game out of South America, because it's a South American competition.
Right.
And it's a massive game. If you're going to move it somewhere.
Maracanã.
Why not? I mean,
you know what? Actually, you know what? Can be radical here. Do it in the Maracanã and give the fans, like, do an allocation.
Yeah.
Allocate to River and Boca and say, do you know what? This nonsense about not having two sets of fans in the same stadium. Let's show we can do it. Let's allocate a third of the tickets neutrally and half each to River and Boca, and let's just do this thing. Yeah. No, really, we're adults. I feel like almost there's a great point that that Brenda makes in the segment we're going to use about how this game has been marketed. And she makes a great point about how this game has been marketed to the kind of more, you know, rabid section of fans or the machismo. This is an opportunity to say, look, this is a showcase for South American football. Let's take the high road. Let's make a weekend of it in Rio. Because actually, look, if there was an opportunity for a real sort of, if there was an opportunity for football in crisis in 2014, it was when Argentina fans descended upon Rio for the World Cup final and everybody behaved impeccably. 100,000 odd Argentina fans traveled to Rio for the World Cup and there was scarcely a problem.
And you were there.
So I was there. So I saw it up close and I can say, look, I just think it would be a fantastic opportunity for South American football to say, you know what, didn't work out there for whatever reason. Let's do it in the Maracanã and be done with it.
Yeah, I agree. So, I mean, by the time this goes up, the situation probably changed again.
By that time, Mark Hughes will be playing for River Plate. So, you know.
Oh.
Yeah, sorry. That was a hot take.
Should we take a quick break?
Let's take a quick break.
And we're back.
We're back.
That was so radio. And we're back. One thing I wanted to touch on that I forgot to mention actually when we were talking about the Premier League stuff was the armbands, the captain's armbands this weekend, proudly supporting the Stonewall. It's a campaign, isn't it, that the Premier League do every weekend? I suppose that's the right word for it. But how good did it look for Premier League captains to not have that horrible, way too narrow Premier League captain's armband on?
Yes.
This is Ryan's corner, where I'm going to rant about something. I really, really want the Premier League to get rid of the standardised captain's armband. I'm not sure if anyone actually cares about this or whether it's just me on my own, but I would really love clubs to have their own personalised captain's armbands. I mean, you can still have the Premier League official typeface and maybe the logo on it. Do you not think that's something?
I just think that's going to become like football boots, where football boots were once black and now they're all kinds of colours, and they become just another marketing opportunity. So I like the idea. I also know where it's going to go.
I really like, for example, like, you know, when you have El Clasico,
yeah,
and you have Real have their captain's armband, and you have Barca usually have the Catalan stripes, or when Barca play in the Champions League and they have the fluorescent green Champions League captain's armbands over the top of the Catalan ones. Ugh, this is just maybe just me being a little pet peeve, but I really enjoyed seeing the rainbow on the armband for a start.
It's super cool. I mean, the rainbow is just a super.
It's
cool,
amazing. So. It's like St. Pauli's captain's armband is it's a skull and crossbones.
Oh yes,
you know what I mean. Yeah, it would just be really good to see, like, you know, for example, like if Spurs had like their badge on there, and you know, or whatever, or like Arsenal had just like a cannon on there, or United had like Fred the Red. You know what I mean?
Well, it's super cool. It's distinctive. Yeah. It's identity.
Should we start? I might do a petition to the Premier League.
You know, change.org. The only reason I feel bad about it is it's going to become a new piece of merchandise. They're going to start selling.
Yeah, but do you know what? I'm all right with it. Right, let's move on to more football.
Well, yeah, but that is football. I mean, we celebrate football culture in Rabona, and I love that. I do love that concept. And also, as a Stonewall alumnus, I played for Stonewall for 3 years. I'm very proud of the institution that club has become. I think they're tremendously important.
I'm going to give you a little plug here. Well, plug to you, plug to our friends at CARICOM. We've tweeted about it last week, and me and Musa and Michael have also tweeted about it. But Musa's wrote a really good piece for the second issue of CARICOM, which is a really, really good football magazine. About how football and Black British culture intersect.
That's right, yeah.
They've got a Kickstarter for their second issue. So if you go to the Rabona Twitter, you'll see, or Musa or mine, you'll see the link there. And
yeah, CARICOM spelled CARICOM. And I've written a piece about my debut for Stonewall Football Club many years ago.
Yeah, honestly, CARICOM issue one was amazing.
Callum Jacobs, shout out.
Yeah, shout out to Callum.
As regular listeners to this podcast will know, including my mum. Hi, mum. Shout out, mum. We have the Sancho corner, Jadon Sancho and his incredible exploits at Dortmund. They won 2-0 against Freiburg. He was instrumental again. Brilliant in the lead up to, I think, the second goal, and just basically bewildering them all night. And he's been tremendous, hasn't he, all year?
Do you know what it reminded me of, that little bit where he did the... how many guys was it? He kind of...
It's three.
It was like a... You know, in like cartoons where all of a sudden someone will just like Tasmanian Devil or something like that. And he's like, bing, 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 bing. And then these guys are like, whoa. You
and know, the dust like, cloud the, is there. And he just
Yeah, and like the lines and the kind of like the things going around their head. God, he's amazing.
I mean, the Tasmanian Devil, that's actually a brilliant marketing. I mean, yeah, if they ever like Nike or Adidas incorporate that into their marketing, they'll go nuclear. He's extraordinary.
Yeah, he's, I mean, what more can we say? I mean, I'm glad you brought it up because Michael's not here.
I must say, though, what I say about very quickly on the German league, good win for Bayern against Bremen and a good win for Leipzig over Gladbach, and really fascinating that Dortmund are managing to keep a slightly resurgent Bayern at bay, because Bayern are a bit resurgent, aren't they? Kovac is working things out.
Yeah.
But Dortmund are showing they are the real deal this year.
And also, it's worth pointing out, Ian Robin announced that it will be his last season at Bayern.
Well, big transition.
So, seemingly been there forever. And
it's a symbolic thing, isn't it?
Because I think that is quite symbolic. And I do wonder whether there's been some conversations behind the scenes about they need to really kick on now, because they're still very much in the shadow of Ribery and Robin and a couple of the old guard. I think now is a really good opportunity for Bayern to reset a little bit and change tack.
Aaron Ramsey is available.
Well, there's lots of rumours that will be there. Yeah, I mean, maybe we'll... Though I wanted to kind of touch on Ramsey a little bit more, but I think we'll maybe do that another time, because we spoke a lot about Arsenal.
Southampton.
Mark Hughes is gone, which...
Fair enough, really.
A point at home to Man United is enough to get a man sacked now.
Struggling mid-table sides.
I'm so sorry.
Don't be sorry. Don't be sorry. Listen, listeners to this podcast will know by now that I see Mourinho's tenure at Manchester United a little like I see the seasons of The Walking Dead. There was great excitement when the production started. Everyone was really hyped about it. The cast of characters was thrilling. But everyone now is just wondering when it's going to end, if it will ever end. So I really feel like, you know, I don't want to compare his reign to the zombie apocalypse, but it does have some.
See, I was going to say it's more like Lost. Because it's kind of like
ending that pleases no one.
And you kind of just knew it from season two, but it went on 9 seasons or whatever. Was it says it?
Oh, wow, 7. Lost. Oh my goodness, it's such an appropriate name as well. Okay, so it's the Venn diagram of Lost and The Walking Dead.
Yeah, I'm in the process of writing a thing about Southampton at the moment because I think it's very easy. Obviously, Southampton fans will have noticed this because they follow their club week in, week out. But I think it's been quite easily overlooked from a lot of us non-Southampton fans, actually how much trouble they're in for a side that came up and were doing genuinely brilliant things after their first season when they came up and they hired Pochettino a few months into that first season back in the Premier League. They finished 14th that year. Last season was the first season since then they finished in the bottom half of the Premier League.
Right.
And they're in the relegation zone and they have had a lot of structural changes at the club, ownership changes, director of football changes, chief scout, I think, went to Spurs with Pochettino. Les Reed recently left the club, which was one of the last pieces, if you like, at operational level from the structure they had when they came back into the Premier League. They're in big trouble.
Right.
And I think they had to do something soon about Mark Hughes. I think he was a strange appointment in the first place. There's talk about Ralph Hasenhüttl coming in, which I think personally is exactly the kind of appointment that you would expect from Southampton, maybe when Ronald Koeman left.
He was the Red Bull Leipzig man.
RB Leipzig, and before that he was at Ingolstadt. Got Ingolstadt back into the Bundesliga after taking over when they were very near the bottom of Bundesliga 2, or Zweite Bundesliga, second Bundesliga, I think is the technical term. Very highly rated manager, was linked with Arsenal as a potential successor to Arsene Wenger. I think he'd be a brilliant appointment at Southampton. I think it'd be a really good move for him. Michael texted me about this, actually. I said, is there anything you want to mention on the podcast? I might talk about Hasenhüttl. And he said, yeah, obviously he's very attack-minded, flowing football, and could liberate a lot of those players there, thinking the likes of Redmond. He thinks it'd be a good appointment as well. So for Southampton's sake, I really, really hope he is the guy they get in.
Right.
I really hope they don't go for another Hughes-type appointment.
Do you know what I love about when Michael sends texts? You can hear Michael's voice in the text.
Yeah.
Like the kind of the same considered analysis. And yeah, sorry, just I'm nostalgic. Whenever Michael's missing, I miss him so much.
Oh, he's staring at his empty chair. It's very sad.
thoughts and prayers. Pour some out.
He's busy expanding the Rabona commercial empire.
Amazing human being that he is. We love you, Michael.
AKA.
Dearly departed.
He's just in London.
Yeah. but in relation to what Michael said about this appointment, this potential appointment, what I love about it is it's visionary. And Southampton are, I think, a visionary club. And they've always tried to be like that. You look at the old, you know, the old footage, the old games they used to play back in the Keegan days. They've always been a club that have tried to play the game a certain way with a certain style, a collective style. And I'm just glad that this potential appointment, rumoured appointment, is drawing them back in that direction.
They led by absolute example when they came back in the Premier League, I thought. And if you look at the players who have gone on from those 2 or 3 years when they first came back in the Premier League, imagine if all those players were still at Southampton.
Unbelievable. Right.
Probably win the league. You know what I mean? It's like, if Poch was still there, for example.
Absolutely.
All those players still there with Poch, you know. Anyway.
But one last thing I want to sort of bring up before you get into roundup of some of the really exciting action from the women's football is the Europa League, UEFA. And this is a visionary, I think, step from them potentially, which would head off the potential creation of European Super League. UEFA proposed a third European competition involving, I think, 30-odd teams, 32 teams.
Yeah, I think they're going to downsize the, hopefully both competitions, but definitely the Europa League.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that's impressive or interesting. It's an impressive step, I think, UEFA, because I think it's an attempt to head off the Super League at the pass. But it's plans they developed already before. And I think the idea is to kind of democratise European football, give more clubs a bit of a say, and actually might have the effect of boosting some of those TV revenues, commercial revenues maybe.
Yeah. I've struggled to get excited about this, if I'm being honest, because I wrote a piece a couple of weeks ago about kind of the changing climate of football, and it was a little bit to do with, you know, all the kind of Football League stuff, but also this kind of third competition and the Super League kind of aspect.
Yeah.
And I just don't have any confidence that UEFA are going to handle this in the right way.
Okay.
And I really want to be proved wrong, but I think that they have a massive opportunity with this third competition to shift the needle back again into kind of, I don't want to say saving, that's massively extreme, but like you say, democratizing European football again, try and bring the floor up as opposed to, you know, make the ceiling even higher.
Okay.
Yeah. The initial kind of news came out, it's got a working title of Europa League 2, which has killed any potential enthusiasm that I had.
Sounds like a Radiohead EP, doesn't it? UEL 2, you know, or an asteroid.
The conceptual album from UEFA,
yeah.
The space Ambient. Opera, the UEFA space opera. But yeah, I think it's all kind of speculative at the moment, isn't it? Because we just don't know.
We don't. What we do know for a fact is that the winning streaks of two great clubs have ended.
Yeah, two 100% starts of the season ended this weekend. PSG drew to Bordeaux in Ligue 1, which means they have dropped points for the first time in the league this season.
Right.
They drew 2-2. But, you know, again, kind of hard game against Liverpool.
Very tough game. Midweek. And a defining game as well.
Yeah, definitely. I think that it was a big win for them in midweek. And, you know, I mean, they're still yet to lose a game in Liga. That's the first draw of the season. So I think they're going to be
They'll
fine.
Be okay.
Right, I'm not sure if it's really derailed their title challenge yet.
Yeah.
And Arsenal women lost to Manchester City 2-0 in the Women's Super League,
huge
which
result.
Was the big result for City, who were chasing Arsenal. Arsenal have had an incredible start to the season. That's the first game that Arsenal haven't won or scored in this season.
Wow.
Which gives you a little insight into how well they were doing. They destroyed last season's champions, Chelsea, earlier on in the season.
Interesting to see City coming up on the third rail, a bit like they did 4 or 5 years ago in the men's competition. Do you see them being a threat for the foreseeable future?
Oh, for sure, yeah. I mean, they kind of, I think City's development and emergence, if you like, in the Women's Super League kick-started the full professionalisation. Professionalisation? Right. Is that the
yeah,
word?
Yeah,
is that
the word? That works.
Of the Women's Super League and the Women's Championship, it's now mandatory to be professional to have a side in there, which it wasn't just a few years ago. There's a really good piece that Tim Stillman wrote for Arsblog News. He interviewed Daniela van der Donk, the Netherlands international, plays for Arsenal.
Yep.
She gave a really good insight into kind of what their day-to-day is like, and it's, you know, how professional it is and how similar to the men's it is now, and it's really good that level of investment is starting to happen a little bit more widely. And it's still not as much investment as you would like. And obviously, there's still a long way to go. But I think the Women's Super League and the Women's Championship this season has been... There just seems to be a lot more enthusiasm and a lot more coverage around it. And, you know, major newspapers have dedicated women's football writers now, which I think is really good. And you've got the World Cup coming next year, which I think is going to be great. We're hoping to go.
Yeah,
to France.
Yeah, hoping, yeah.
By the time this goes out, I think the host nation for the Women's Euros in 2021 will have been announced. Hopefully it'll be England.
Right.
And really encouraging, I think. On that note, quick shout for Spain, who won the Women's Under-17s World Championship at the weekend. And New Zealand came third, which I thought was good. They beat Canada in the third place game.
Absolutely awesome.
Brilliant.
Good news for Canada in relation to looking ahead to the World Cup.
Definitely. And for Spain as well. Yep. I mean, if you think next World Cup is going to be a little bit too soon, but for that Euros in 2021, a lot of those players are going to be in that team. The best thing about it was, if you get to check it, was like when Infantino was presented with a trophy and they were just kind of like grabbing it off and he's like, get out of the way, just give us a trophy.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, go on.
Football wrestling for its soul.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so let's dive into this snippet of the interview that I did with Brenda Elsie last week, talking about the little bit of the wider implications from the Copa Libertadores stuff. I'm delighted to welcome to the Rabona podcast Brenda Elsie. Brenda, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Before we start, Brenda, I was wondering, would you maybe be able to introduce yourself and give people a little bit more of an idea of what you do?
Well, most of what I do is professoring of history of Latin America at Hofstra University, but I'm also a co-host of the sport and feminist podcast, Burn It All Down. And I write extensively on soccer, football in Latin America, especially gender and class issues. So I have a new book coming out called Footballera with Josh Nadel, a history of women in sport in Latin America this year from University of Texas Press.
Amazing. So I guess to start, I thought it would be good to get your take on the main story, the Copa Libertadores final, or the second leg that never was.
And maybe never will be.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, this is involving two of Buenos Aires's, well, the two biggest clubs in Buenos Aires. How has this been received or commented on outside of Buenos Aires or even outside of Argentina in South America?
So I was in Argentina until the game that never was, never was. And I was in Buenos Aires. And ironically, I was at a meeting that has to do with trying to get together women's football and people who study, activists, practitioners of women's football. And we were scheduled to watch the match together when we saw what had happened with the River fans throwing the rocks. You know, it's pretty, I think there's a lot of hand-wringing, a lot of disappointment. There are a lot of fans of both River and Boca well beyond Argentina. And I think they were really disappointed. Of course, the first thing is to blame, just as the media directs people to, and just as CONMEBOL directs people to, there's a lot of just blaming Argentine disorganization, you know, that there's something inherently disorganized and not modern, unmodern about Argentina, which is just really, I think, a racialized caricature. And yeah. I don't think it's fair. So I think it's a bridge too far to say that it's something inherent to Argentine disorganization. But I do think it has a lot to do with a football culture, and this isn't just top down. This is a shared football culture, which its violence stems also from a machismo that has excluded and been violent toward women, mm-hmm. both women players, women in stands, women in the stadiums every week, and women within the clubs.
Yeah.
And a real reticence to change that. And I think it dovetails with marketing and the idea that somehow we can market this to a rabid male fan, mm-hmm. and a resistance to changing the idea that Argentine women and a different kind of Argentine male fan and non-binary and anyone LGBTQ+ mm-hmm. fan in Argentina that loves football just as much and may be able to model a different way to consume and practice it.
One final question before you go. I mean, in your opinion, what do you think this means? I know this is a big question, but what do you think this means for the future of, I suppose, not necessarily South American football, but maybe Argentine football or the Libertadores as a competition? Do you think that I get the impression from being very far away that this is by no means the end of what we're going to hear about this?
No, I don't think, first of all, the rumors will be for years.
Yeah, you I was know, kind of joking they, that, you know, I can't wait for the 30 for 30 on, yeah, on this final.
It's, you know? It's going to be like, I mean, because you already hear things like, well, you know, River maybe tried to do X, or Boca was trying to make River look bad, and so they rerouted the buses, or the president has a relationship to X, Y, and Z. I think there's a general feeling of disgust in Argentina, and I don't think it's towards the fans. I think that the frustration is with the authorities, and I think that's well placed. I find it surprising that people outside of Argentina don't seem to want to trust people inside of Argentina. They simply don't seem to be listening to Argentine journalists and analysts and organizers, people who organize fan groups. You know, they're really civic leaders who are saying, you know, we're disgusted with the way in which we're not getting information and this hasn't been transparent. So two things could happen. Either the structure of Argentine football stays the same and it becomes more neoliberal and it tries to be the Champions League. And I think ultimately that is not a good model for the vibrancy of the game mm-hmm. in Latin America and its importance in social life. Or you're going to see some forced changes because people will either be fighting at the level of the federation and CONMEBOL, or they'll check out and organize independently. So you'll see a kind of opt out. So if there's change, you'll see, a more vibrant opt-in on the part of a lot of people. If there's not, I think there's a lot of fans who are just disgusted with the way in which River, Boca, AFA, CONMEBOL, all the way up to Infantino will just sort of reject football as it is. I think we're at a turning point there.
Before we go, maybe if you can let people know where to find you, and also maybe another plug for the book.
I tweet earnestly and grouchy at Politicultura, which is PolitiCultura, Politicultura. You can find me at Burn It All Down. And the book is Footballera, a History of Women and Sport in Latin America.
Brilliant. Brenda, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Should we get going?
We shall get going. But before we get going, yes, I would love to thank the audience for tuning in again. We really appreciate your support. Thank you so much for listening, sharing, subscribing. You can find us on all social media handles at Rabonamag, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. But Ryan, you've got something to say.
Yeah, also, just a little reminder, if you do check the podcast, please give us a review or a rating, especially on iTunes or anywhere you can review or rate. It really helps kind of maybe push us up into other people's feeds. In Moose's words, tell a friend, tell an enemy.
Exactly, especially an enemy. Thank you so much for joining us once again, and we'll catch you soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.